It's Wednesday, May 17, 2017, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me, as always, are my colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, the Chicago Tribune's parent company makes a run for the Chicago Sun-Times. Could the country's third largest city soon be in one newspaper town? A new Colorado law threatens to call journalists' credibility into question now that primary election voting behavior is a matter of public record. And a story of modern-day slavery right here in the United States. There's a lot more that we'll hopefully get to as well before the half hour is up, but let's start with the Washington Post exclusive broken late Monday that President Donald Trump shared classified information with the Russians during last week's meeting in the Oval Office. According to the Post, he gave the envoy details of an ISIS plan to attack using bombs built into laptop computers, sensitive information obtained by the Israelis, who had not given permission to share it. But the Trump administration is calling it fake news, that the intelligence wasn't shared, that it just didn't happen the way the Post says it did. Here's National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster.
I just have a brief statement for the record. There's nothing that the president takes more seriously than the security of the American people. The story that came out tonight, as reported, is false. The president and the foreign minister reviewed a range of common threats to our two countries, including threats to civil aviation. At no time were intelligence sources or methods discussed. And the president did not disclose any military operations that were not already publicly known. Two other senior officials who were present, including the Secretary of State, remember the meeting the same way and have said so. Their on-the-record accounts should outweigh those of anonymous sources. And I was in the room. It didn't happen.
But here's the thing. Trump tweeted yesterday morning that he wanted to share the information with Russia, which he has the right to do, and that he did it for humanitarian reasons. Plus, he wants Russia to step up its efforts against ISIS. In a press briefing, McMaster stood by his statements. This was like midday yesterday. And he put the blame on the people who talked to the Post. Not that the president had potentially done anything wrong or put anybody in jeopardy. It was the leakers who talked to the Post that created the problem.
Well, it is fact. The president has a serious problem because there are people within the administration and those who work in various agencies that are connected to the White House who are basically starting to tell the press information that is not just damaging to the president of the White House, but it's information that, quite frankly, is damaging the Republican Party and what the Republican Party in office is trying to do. And this is going to continue because, you know, you have a president who just, for lack of better terms, doesn't get it. There's certain protocols that you have to follow. There's certain things that you have to do. And when he doesn't do those things, and people see it, they're going like, wait a minute, somebody's got to put a check on this. And that's what's happening. You're starting to see more and more of this. I mean, the fact that, you know, you have this conversation with the Russians, then we learned late yesterday afternoon, mm-hmm. in the New York Times reports that during a conversation with James Comey right after, Michael Flynn was fired, that the president basically said, hey, can you let this go? You can't ask an FBI director to let an investigation go. I mean, that could be seen by some as obstruction of justice. I don't know if it goes that far, but these types of things just can't happen when you're the president of the United States.
Yeah, I suspect the alleged request that Comey let it go with Flynn is probably more damaging than the whether or not the Russians found out about the Israeli intelligence through the president or some other means. But I have to say, I mean, you can have more than one thing be true at the same time. I could give McMaster, you know, credit up to a point of saying that methods, you know, and sources were not disclosed by the president, while at the same time, he disclosed the fact that there was intelligence we were getting without telling an ally, which in and of itself could be damaging to U.S. national security. Because if in the future, the Israelis or the French or anybody else, the Saudis decide they're not going to share some intelligence and something bad happens, that's a consequence of what the president did. And I also have to agree with you. I think there's something to be said for the fact that the president has a larger problem because he's sending his spokespeople out there to say one thing, and then he undermines them the very next day. And so the news media, fairly or not, may get into the position where they don't believe the president or his spokespeople on anything.
Well, the other situation here, and this is what I heard coming in this morning on NPR, you have members of Congress in the Republican Party who were supporters of Donald Trump, and to a certain extent still are basically saying, okay, now you've put us in a position where we're going to have to call Comey in. We're going to have to ask the FBI for this information, because if we don't, then we're going to be held responsible for not doing what we do. And this jeopardizes the rest of our agenda that we had planned, because we're spending all of this time dealing with these issues that keep popping up because the president is not following proper protocol.
So the weird thing I was about to say, Amy, mm-hmm. was that I think that the media in general, whether they're left, right, center, whatever, have tended to have a lot of breathless, and then I was going to say overreaction, but I don't know if over is right. There's been a lot of breathless reaction to what the president has done. And if you look at some of it, I mean, MSNBC is basically saying impeachment is around the corner. Fox News is saying there are these conspiracies to take down the president from the deep state and the deranged media. Even CNN, which is trying to play it down the middle, sort of, is saying basically the Trump administration may not survive the Comey memo. So there's a lot of hyperbole out there, at the very least. I'm not saying some of it isn't justified, but it's a different place that we're in.
But the other thing you're seeing here is that there are people within, like I said earlier, within the administration, within various government agencies who are going to the press, and they're going to the establishment newspapers. Mm-hmm. They're going to the Washington Post. They're going to the New York Times, because they know that they're going to do the deep dive investigation of this and make sure that all the areas are covered before they release the information, so that when the Trump administration does come out and say it's fake news, it's that fake news thing is just not resonating anymore.
Well, and it's interesting, because one of the things that we're seeing here, too, is that it is creating one of the classic newspaper wars of all time between the Post and the New York Times, each wanting to get that next scoop that takes it to the next level. And we've even seen that this week alone.
And one of them, actually, last night, I find kind of disturbing, mm-hmm. and that was, and so Fox News didn't start it, but Hannity picked it up. It was started by Breitbart and the Drudge Report, saying that basically a member of the Democratic National Committee staff, who was murdered this past summer, was the real source of the leaks to WikiLeaks. It wasn't the Russians, and this whole thing is made up. It's this big conspiracy against the president. There is almost no sourcing for that story so far, and a lot of right-wing media are simply repeating the story that appears in Fox News. Now, they're not trying, as CNN or the New York Times or Fox News, for that matter, does, in trying to follow up and verify these other exclusives that are coming out about Trump.
So, Mike, you said something a couple of minutes ago about the idea of whether or not the media or the people as a whole are going to really continue to trust Trump's spokesman. And that became an issue late last week after the firing of Comey and the story changing so many times. And as a result, the president comes out and says maybe we should do away with press briefings. It was something that caught people by such, I don't know, on their heels. They didn't really know what to make of it. So Judge Jeanine Pirro, who has a show on Fox News, asked Trump about it again, just to make sure that there wasn't any kind of a misunderstanding.
Are you moving so quickly that your communications department cannot keep up with
yes,
you?
Yes, that's true.
So what do we do about that?
We don't have press conferences, and we do...
You don't mean that.
Well, just don't have them. Unless I have them every 2 weeks and I do myself. We don't have them. I think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
First of all, you have a level of hostility that's incredible. Mm-hmm. And it's very unfair. Sarah Huckabee is a lovely mm-hmm. young woman. Mm-hmm. You know Sean Spicer. Mm-hmm. He is a wonderful human being. He's a nice man.
Is he your press secretary today and tomorrow?
Will he be tomorrow? Sure. He is. He's doing a good job, but he gets beat up.
Will he be there tomorrow?
Yeah. Well, he's been there from the beginning.
We should save that video just in case, with the rumors swirling. Maybe he won't be here tomorrow. But that's not a good idea either, having the president take the podium once every 2 weeks, and that's the only time that we're getting any kind of update from what's going on in the White House under the administration.
You know, this just continues the pattern. He makes these statements. He's saying it off the cuff. I don't think he's giving himself time to just sit and think about it.
He answered the question before she even finished asking.
Exactly. And you know, he's gonna have a press conference every 2 weeks. I mean, to a certain extent, he has a press conference every early morning when he starts tweeting, and then all of a sudden, you know, things just get out there. The problem is that he says he's out front, and his spokesman can't keep up with them. Part of it is because he's not talking to them. He's not giving them the message. So they're trying to figure it out based on whatever information they happen to get, but it's not coming from him.
You know,
it appears not to be coming from him, I'll say that.
More opportunities to hear the official line from the president are better than fewer, but I'm not so sure it would be terrible if we didn't have daily press briefings and the president really did come out every couple of weeks and talk, because those White House reporters, they've got their sources. Whether you want to call them the deep state or concerned members of the administration or whatever, they're still going to get those stories. The White House is only going to be left with some other means of trying to counter it if they don't have daily press briefings. The briefings are not working, not because the briefings are a bad idea, but because the president contradicts most of the things that are said in the briefings.
And it goes back to the point that you just made, the fact that those reporters have their sources, and their sources are talking more than ever now because they're having problems with dealing with the White House.
Well, and what about the idea, too, that those press briefings have an audience that extends just beyond the specific audience that extends just beyond the press or the general public. Lawmakers are looking at those other governments of other countries for that official message on where our president is on certain issues or on certain matters on any given day.
But here's the Mike spoke about this.
Yeah,
I don't think they're looking there anymore.
Okay,
because Trump is basically saying what he thinks and what he believes almost 24/7. I mean, either it's coming from his Twitter feed or it's coming from statements he's making at functions that he's attending or at interviews that he's given. It's not going through his communications apparatus. And the problem is he's trying to use his communication apparatus to clean up what he's saying and all these other things, and it's just not working.
Would it be better if we had these briefings as a way to provide a more diplomatic spin on what the administration or the president really thinks? Yeah, sometimes that's important, but nothing is going to keep this president from behaving the way he behaves.
Okay, well, with all the criticism, we heard a new one this week. Kellyanne Conway wasn't too happy when CNN's Anderson Cooper rolled his eyes at her during an interview immediately following last week's firing of James Comey. Howard Kurtz asked her about it Sunday morning.
Contentious interviews on CNN this week, including this moment, which went viral with Anderson Cooper.
And I was on your show often last fall saying we were going to win Michigan and how we were going to do it. So that was fun.
What did you make of the now famous eye roll?
Well, first of all, a lot of folks want things to go viral. They think that's the job of the news media now, which it's not, of course. And you should play the beginning of the clip where he had me sit through President Trump, then candidate Trump, on the stump in many different places praising Jim Comey. And it ended with Grand Rapids, Michigan. So I turned it around, as I often do, and I said, thanks for the trip down memory lane. We loved winning Michigan. And of course, he rolled his eyes. Possibly sexist, definitely what I call Trumpist, which is many people who go on TV are treated like a house guest, and then when we go on TV, we're not. And the fact is that it was, you know, we were watching CNN ahead of time. You got 6-1 panels against the president. One of us tries to go out there on his behalf and state the case from the position of the president. But look, the suspicion and the derision, just generally, toward this White House by members of the media, I'm not mentioning any network or any paper or any individual specifically, and the quest to go viral, the quest to say to somebody when there's nothing else to say, quote, that makes no sense, or you must be lying. They say it to folks all the time. It really doesn't help democracy, and it doesn't help the body politic, because people are looking for the news.
Are journalists Trumpists? Are we killing the body politic?
Well, that's the narrative that Trump and his supporters, that President Trump and his supporters are putting out there. And when you begin to see some of the actions, because you're in power and you're expected to do certain things. You're expected to do your job. You were sent to Washington to do that. And the news media is there covering your actions and what you're doing. And right now, they are in crisis mode every day, all day. And this is what the public is seeing. So their narrative is to blame the way in which that narrative is told, the narrative of we're in crisis, mm-hmm. blame that on the media. Well, that was working for a while, but I don't think it's working very well for them right now.
You're going to find this a little bit surprising, maybe, but I kind of feel for Kellyanne Conway. I mean, a lot of the stuff she's spewing, I think, is just false. But a lot of spokespeople for presidents and politicians deliberately spin things the way they want. My concern is that nobody who's a spokesperson for President Trump right now is going to get the benefit of the doubt, as we just described. I don't think Kellyanne Conway got the eye roll from Anderson Cooper because he's sexist. I mean, we could argue that. I don't even know if he did it on purpose to get viral, you know, clips
or
whatever.
I think that was a visceral reaction to something that was irrelevant in the conversation.
But I will say a couple other things. Yeah. One, if you see all of the comedy that's done about the president's spokesperson, okay, there's a lot about mm-hmm. Sean Spicer. But I think some of the comedy and the vitriol toward Kellyanne Conway does have a tinge of sexism to it. And I do think if you took her and she was representing almost anybody but Donald Trump right now, some of the things she says are at least worthy of debate. I mean, when she was given the opportunity there by Howard Kurtz to say what she wanted to say without interruption, she made some points that we may not agree with, but they're points worth talking about.
Well, here's something I never thought I'd be saying. Could Chicago become the largest city in the nation to be a one newspaper town? We're still a ways away from that happening, but it could, now that there's an offer on the table for Trunk, the Chicago Tribune's parent company, to buy the Chicago Sun-Times. Reports say that this deal could close by the end of the month, and if it does, the two papers would still operate independent newsrooms simply under the same ownership. But we've seen some other cities where this has worked, maybe not so well.
Well, I can tell you that Chicago will be a one newspaper town.
Yeah.
I've seen this happen. This happened in my hometown about 20 years ago when the Houston Chronicle, which was owned by Hearst, mm-hmm. bought the Houston Post. Same sort of deal. The only difference is that everything was split at the time. They bought it and immediately closed it. And you have seen this over and over and over again. I'll give you another case in point. San Antonio.
Okay.
Same thing. They bought it. The Hearst bought the San Antonio Light. They put it up for sale, saying, hey, if anyone wants to buy it, here you go. Knowing that the only people who could afford to buy it was the company that just bought it, and they closed it. So, I mean, this is going to happen.
They may really mean that they want to have two independent editorial voices in newspapers in Chicago. I doubt that they will be able to maintain that. In fact, I would be worried if Chicago becomes one of the many cities it's a zero newspaper town sometime in the not too distant future, because the Tribune's fortunes are not that great either at the moment.
Okay, well, let's turn to Colorado now, where a law passed at the end of the most recent legislative session that stands to jeopardize journalists, opening them up to public critique. Here's the deal. The new law allows people unaffiliated with a political party to vote in primaries. This means an estimated 1.2 million people can cast a ballot, people who couldn't before. But there's a catch. Pulling a primary ballot will create a public record. So even if you're unaffiliated, there's now going to be a record of which party's primary you voted in. On the face of it, that doesn't seem like that big of a deal. Colorado is a swing state, and giving more people a voice earlier in the process is a win for democracy. But this is pretty problematic for journalists.
Yeah, the issue here is that, you know, if you're a journalist, you're voting in that primary, you're probably an independent. But in this primary, you may decide to vote Democrat. Well, you're covering a story in the legislature or whatever government mm-hmm. you're covering.
It can be a county board, a library board, or whatever.
Exactly. And that record is out there, and the person from the other party sees that. They're going to attack you saying, but you're a supporter of whatever party you voted for in that primary. That's problematic for a journalist. I mean, are you sort of, does this law disenfranchise journalists or make their job difficult because you're putting it out there? And I just, I personally, I don't see the reason why it's even necessary to try to determine whether somebody voted one way or the other, other than to just try to track it. But now you can be used as a weapon.
I guess I feel a little bit less sorry for journalists in this situation. One, because political parties are private entities that put up candidates to run for office. Nobody makes us vote for them. You know, if journalists or anybody else who say they're independent, you know, want to vote in an independent fashion, they're free to start their own party, support their own party, whatever. I also think, you know, we should acknowledge that this idea of revealing which primary you voted in is still something that the Secretary of State of Colorado is pushing. It's not something the voters approved last fall or whenever they voted on it. And finally, I would say, you know, for the longest time, research showed that the vast majority of mainstream journalists voted Democratic. Mm-hmm. Now there's research that says that they self-identify as independents. Mm-hmm. I suspect if we see which primary they vote in Colorado because of this new law, the vast majority of them will vote in the Democratic primary. So does the public deserve to know that? I don't see why not.
Well, you know, here's the thing. Okay, now that you have the law out there and it's something, journalists are citizens. So I agree with you on the point that, yes, they can and should be allowed to vote. And if they're going to be a part of the public and this is the law, then I guess it's going to be out there. The problem I have is that now they're going to be susceptible to basically being called out for it in their coverage.
That's going to happen. And I mean, there will be some bad actors who try to misrepresent journalists. And you can write an objective or a fair, at least, story, even though you happen to vote in one particular party all the time. But we talk about transparency as journalists, except when it affects us directly.
Good point.
Okay, well, Mike, big day for you yesterday as ABC execs announced formally one of your favorite reality shows, American Idol, is back. You're excited about this one, aren't you?
I am excited about American Idol coming back because I don't know if it can, and I did watch it for a long time on Fox. I have to tell you, I'm actually much more excited by the fact that CBS is coming out with a reboot of Star Trek, which I think is going to be that much more interesting because there's a whole lot of people who love Star Trek and are wondering what's going to happen. But this is part of this bigger deal with the so-called upfronts where the networks announce to advertisers what they're going to be airing, and they try to convince them to spend as much money as possible up front to be associated with those shows. Look at all the reboots that are coming out. We mentioned two of them. There are dozens of them.
There's Roseanne is coming back on ABC. Will and Grace on NBC. Dynasty. I bet you that one goes as well as the Dallas one.
Lethal Weapon. On and on. Will and Grace. There's all these different shows.
So what does that say? There are a couple of different issues that are kind of embedded into that. The first is complete and total lack of creativity.
That's when I read this. That's the first thing I thought about was, can we come up with something original?
Right.
I mean, is it that you're trying this nostalgia thing because you're hoping that that audience that is still connected will stay with you because of those shows? Or is it just a lack of creativity? Those are the first two things. But the other thing that I find interesting is that in these upfronts, you know, they aren't talking a lot about what shows are not going to be on air. The ones that are going to just be on Hulu or just be on Netflix and that sort of thing. And that's where I see a lot of people are moving in that direction. And I don't see I see the creativity heading in that direction and not toward those who are still connected.
That's the problem, because we are in a golden age of television right now, again, but not because of the networks. They gave up their opportunity. Right. So HBO and Netflix and Showtime and Hulu and all the AMC, all these other players have the quality mantle. And so the only way the networks can get back into the game is to try to resurrect these old favorites, hoping that there's at least a core audience that will remember them fondly and come back and maybe using social media share with others and say, hey, check out the new version of Roseanne. That's what they're left with.
Yeah.
Okay, there was one other trend that was interesting looking at the upfronts, specifically with NBC and with Fox, and I'm guessing to some extent with ABC, that almost all of the programs being picked up for fall are being produced by those network studios, that there also isn't a whole lot of procuring of programming from other places.
And the reason for that is because the way you make money now off of these programs is by owning them, because their airing on live television is just one of many revenue sources. There's a much longer tail if you can get it out on different platforms. You own the show, you get all the revenue for it.
Okay.
The other interesting thing is that, at least if you flip over to sports, is now you've got ESPN, which is basically saying that it's pulling SportsCenter off of its main, off the main channel during the day and moving it only to be at night, and they're bringing in more and more personalities. So that's becoming more personality driven as opposed to actual dealing with sports and sports news.
Okay, well, before we go, I want to take a minute or two to talk about the cover story in this month's Atlantic. It's a heartbreaking tale of modern day slavery here in the United States. Alex Tizon wrote about the woman who raised him and his mother and his daughter, working for his family for 56 years in two different countries, all without pay. It was a tradition from the Philippines brought to the United States, and just a gut-wrenching tale.
I mean, he was right to call it slavery. It was slavery. He did a very interesting job in talking about the whole family dynamic. He shared some things about his parents that I'm sure were very painful, because they were the ones who initially brought this woman over from the Philippines as, you'd have to agree, a slave. Then, sort of tragically, before the story is published, he, the reporter, died. So we don't really get to hear him outside of the context of the piece he wrote. But just reading what he wrote raises some pretty big questions about his behavior and his siblings' behavior too, that we'll really never get to address, I guess, because he's gone.
Yeah, I found this story very hard to read. I mean, I had to put it down a couple of times. I be honest, I still hadn't gotten through all of it because, you know, of just what slavery means to me, what slavery means to my heritage. It is difficult to read this and not go, at some point, could you have not done something? And it goes back to the point that you just made, Mike. You had to have known what it means to have someone in your household who is not being paid, who can't leave.
Who your parents are constantly abusing, berating, and at times beating.
Right, exactly. And not do something about it, even up to the point where, you know, you're 40 years old. I mean, I have a problem with that.
And we're never going to hear from Lola because he waited to write about it until after she died. And we're not going to have some interviewer get to plumb his feelings in any depth because he's gone. And that's just too bad.
Yeah.
Okay. Or any of his siblings, because that's another set of complicit, another complicit generation with him that we weren't hearing from. Well, that music means that we are pretty much out of time for today. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about all the topics we talked about today. Check out our links blog under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, to leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. Tim Pilcher composed our original theme music. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.